everyone. This is Attitude with Arnie Arneson on WNHN 94.7. You are tuned in to New Hampshire News Views Blues.org. We're streaming online at nhnewsviewsblues.org. Our phone number, 228-0947, 228-947. This is week two. This is day one of week two, and the radio is just really steamrolling along. Too much great stuff happening at the State House, at the Supreme Court in Washington, and around the rest of New Hampshire. We're starting a new segment on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and every day at 11 o'clock, we're going to be joined by Dan Tuohy, who is, I believe, the deputy editor for Patch.com for New Hampshire. And I wanted to sort of say to people, so like, what is news? And I defined it this way. News is a patchwork quilt of stories that matter. And every day at 11 a.m., we'll unfold the quilt with Patch.com, which is an online news source that covers what is real and local in our lives. And joining us for the first time ever, do we not have him?
No, you got the wrong button.
Oh, sorry. Joining us for the first time ever, let's see, do we have him? I think he's still on hold. Hold on, Marty. We got to do this. I hit this. And I believe we have Dan Tuohy with us. Dan, do we have you?
Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you? This is great. This is round one, patch one. Dan Tuohy won. This is very exciting. You're joining The Attitude on 94.7. So, you know, I was going to start with a really fun quote because I think it really applies to what you've been covering for the last, you know, couple of months. And this is a quote by Charles Kettering. He's an inventor. Listen to this. Problems are the price of progress. Don't bring me anything but trouble. Good news weakens me. So, Dan, as I'm looking at Concord, I'm thinking, whoa, he must be looking at what's going on in the New Hampshire legislature because it's all problems all the time. Anyway, what a wild, wild state legislature to have to cover. You've been around the block for a long time, Dan, working for different news outlets. But this state legislature has to really take the cake.
Well, there's always interesting stuff, right? I mean, it's funny that we have gambling back up again, especially with the governor reiterating that he'll veto the bill if it comes to his desk. But boy, it's just, you know, some of the same issues coming up again and again. And with Massachusetts in play, it's really exciting to watch and see how this unfolds.
Well, but the casino bill this time is so different. And I wanted to remind everyone that New Hampshire has an interesting relationship with gambling because we were the first state in the nation to legalize gambling in the form of lotteries.
And so we
legalized gambling. But here's what we did. We had to sort of massage the sin. And the way we massaged the sin was we said, okay, if we're going to have lotteries, we're just going to use the money to supplement state aid to education. And just to prove that we're right, we're going to keep our promise and put it in the Constitution. So we've never been able to take the lottery dollars and use it for anything else. And to some extent, it's given a couple extra bucks to education. But tell us about this casino bill, because now we're going way beyond lotteries. Now we're literally going into big halls of sin. And they are not talking about using this money to supplement anything. What's the new argument for having these casinos? What do they want to do with all this new infusion of cash?
Well, there's definitely discussion about using the revenue, and there's significant revenue estimates here, of course, anytime you talk about expanded gaming. But, I mean, there's talk about, you know, using the revenue to roll back and reduce the business tax burden across the state. So that's one argument that the people that support expanded gambling are using. Then you have people like David Hess, who's naturally for years has been saying, wait a minute, if we're going to do this, we've got to make sure we do everything right, and then it's got to be extremely limited.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the critics. And then on the other side, of course, you have and he's not even on this bill, but you know, Lou D'Alessandro in the Senate.
Right.
These players that, you know, you've interviewed these folks more than I have over and over. This is like another round in a 15 round bout here.
Well, it's going to be interesting to cover, and we'll have to talk to you because I know that the bill is coming up this week because my husband was just handing me an article the other day, and it was a story about Atlantic City and Foxwoods, and they're losing cash. they're hemorrhaging. And you know how well they embrace gambling. I'm thinking, we're going to cheap out. We know that. That's the New Hampshire way anyway. So here we are, you know, following after all these other states have already, you know, grabbed the gambling concept. We're going to be late to the story. Massachusetts is going to do it better than us. And then on top of that, with what are we going to do with the money? We're not going to use it to, like, support education, fix our roads, clean the environment. We're going to lower business taxes. So it's not even going to be a significant benefit for anyone in New Hampshire, because when you look at overall tax burden, we're pretty low. So, oh my God, we are nuts.
Yeah, there are people around the state. I mean, so there's a number of polls out, especially down in like Salem area near the Rock, that there is significant support in that area for expanding gambling, if it's done well and if the bill has, you know, naturally good oversight. And that's the key word here that we'll hear a lot on Wednesday and Thursday.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And obviously the reason why it's even going ahead, because the governor has said he'll veto it, he'll probably not be able to be overridden, is that they want to make this a political issue for November. And I'm trying to figure out who that favors, because I don't know, does Ovid LaMontagne like gambling? Does Kevin Smith like gambling? I think the only people that like gambling, I think, are Jackie Silly and maybe Maggie Hassan. So it's going to be, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
But yeah, you make a great point with Governor Lynch not running for re-election. It gives him, I wouldn't say more freedom, but he's
liberated.
Yeah, Republicans may want to call him a lame duck, but he can come in with both barrels blazing on any other issue that's a matter of conscience and say, no, not on my watch.
Yeah, I love it. When it took him this long to figure out he didn't like it. Because every time you talk to him, he said, well, if it doesn't impact the quality of life in New Hampshire. And I'm thinking, really? What happened in 2012 that made you sort of figure out it might impact the quality of life? You know? Oh, I know. You're leaving office. It's awful. All right. There's also craziness going on in Washington, D.C. because of the Supreme Court decision. And obviously that whole Obamacare thing has not just been playing out in the courts. It's not just been playing out on the presidential campaign trail, but even in the state legislature. Speaker O'Brien, he doesn't like that Obamacare, and he's doing everything to build walls around it even before the Supreme Court makes its decision.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it's funny. I know I just got an email from the Speaker's office. I mean, he's holding a news conference at noon today in response to an Obama campaign news conference. So the Speaker, like everyone in the legislature, has a lot on their plate to stop and then focus on this. But that just shows you know, everyone's heightened emotions on this issue. It's very, very passionate on all sides.
Right. And I think everyone knows, and there was an article in Politico that said the first question to ask is, how much will politics be brought up during the Supreme Court hearing? Because you and I both know that this case is so provocative, not because it touches 17% of the GDP in this country, but because everyone and his uncle is weighing in on the politics of this. And you kind of feel like the Supreme Court is almost helping to make a decision in the November election, not just a decision about Obamacare and its constitutionality. It's unbelievable. It'll be really interesting. And you proved my point with Speaker O'Brien having a press conference today at noon.
Well, there are bills out there that connect the dots with what they're doing with the federal exchanges and requirements and, you know, the quote unquote mandate. What do you think? Is this going to be a major factor on November 6th?
Here's the interesting thing. I'm about to I'll be doing some analysis on WGBH on Thursday after the Supreme Court has heard all the oral arguments. But one of the fascinating things is that the whole decision might rest on just one answer. Is this a penalty or a tax if you don't decide to, you know, cover your employees for insurance, or you don't decide to, you know, to buy your insurance? And if it's a tax, then they have to punt and wait till it actually gets introduced and they assess the tax. So therefore, they might be able to not even have to address any part of this issue if they decide on day one that this isn't a penalty, but it's in fact a tax. And according to, you know, the jurisprudence, they're not allowed to touch it. They have to wait. You know, it's going to be interesting. And then what does that mean? I mean, that throws everybody into chaos, which means we have to wait till 2014 after everybody has done all the heavy lifting to find out whether it's constitutional or not. Oh, it's a mess. It's a delightful mess, but it's a mess. Now, one more thing before I let you go, though. You mentioned that there is this bill in to repeal the state art fund. Can you enlighten my audience? What is the state art fund?
Well, it's a fund that in which the state tries to secure assets for buildings and whatnot. The bill in question is what's the recommendation now? It's not an ought to pass recommendation. It's they're going to refer to the study, I believe.
Right, right.
But the bottom line was that, you know, this came up because there, you know, proponents of the bill were saying, why do we need a state art fund when we can just address this more on a building by building or a project by project basis?
Mm-hmm. Now, does this require that each building or each public facility include some aspect of art in it? Is there a connection between construction and art? Is it a connection that just says there's like grants available for art? How does it? Do you know what sort of the details are on the art fund?
No, it's not to that depth. It's really focused on the fund itself, and you know, how does the state go about setting up and funding its, you know, reputable and notable collection of artworks.
Wow. You know, it's what's interesting, Dan, before I let you go, I travel to Iowa a lot because I give talks out there because I do Iowa Public Radio. And I remember going on the Iowa State campus, okay? And I'm walking around this campus and I'm thinking, look at these huge pieces of sculpture. Look at that. I mean, it was everywhere. It was everywhere. And I said to Stefan Schmidt, who's my friend, who's a professor of political science, I'm going, whoa, you guys really cultivate public art. And he kind of rolled his eyes. He said, Arnie, we actually get cash to do this. It's like we are paid to encourage public art in every public space. So you will see all kinds of amazing artworks everywhere there's a public building. And I'm thinking, wow, how cool is that? They just don't grow corn. They grow sculpture out in Iowa. So it's interesting. There's where Iowa is, and here we are fighting probably about 16 cents in an art fund. So New Hampshire, you know, Dan?
Indeed, I do, yeah. It should be fun to watch.
All right. Well, I'm just one more thing. There was a diagnosis of TB in Concord last week. Are we hearing anything more? I know it's only one student. I know it's not a very viral form, I'm pretty sure. Are we hearing anything more about the TB case?
No. I know Dr. Jose Montero was addressed parents and the community last week and just reminded them that it's an isolated case. The student is doing well. The student will be removed from school for a couple of weeks, and you know, the bottom line was he was saying that, you know, parents don't have to go out and test your kids. It should all is well, so it should be fine from now. But it's just when you hear TB in this day and age, it's like wait, what did they just hear?
Right, and when you hear tuberculosis in the state of the United States, and I just want to remind people, we now have 50 million people that are uninsured, and if we don't deal with the whole question of access to health care, TB may become more common. Just remember that. It's a scary story. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. I can't wait. We'll schmooze tomorrow and we'll open up our patchwork quilt of news and talk to you again, Dan Tuohy. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. You too. That's Dan Tuohy. He is with Patch.com, and he'll be joining us every Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. to sort of fill us in on the news. If anyone knows anything more about the Arts Fund, I would love it. The other thing about arts, I was just thinking about this the other day. In England, they have a huge national lottery. And what do they use the money for the lottery for? They use the money for the lottery to fund public art. I mean, again, you know, the commitment to art is so remarkable. You see it in different states. You see it in England. And I'm looking at New Hampshire. I'm thinking, well, we don't even fund our roads and bridges very well. So I guess I should be like hoping for a lot more when it comes to investment. And maybe art isn't at the top of their list, but maybe it should be. And another point, and if anyone knows the story, does anyone know the story about the first heart transplant in South Africa? Anybody know? There's a backstory. And the reason I bring this up is obviously Vice President Cheney just received a heart. And there is a lot of conversation about whether his age should have precluded him from, in fact, getting a heart. And one of the doctors that was interviewed this morning on one of the radio shows or TV shows I was watching said that it really isn't a function of age. It is a function of health and the quality of health of the individual that's coming in to get the heart transplant. And, of course, Dick Cheney, this gazillionaire who, you know, was the CEO of Halliburton, was the vice president of the United States, has manipulated international policy, has brought us to war, has helped sort of define the Republican Party. I'm sure his health is great because he's had a lot of money and a lot of doctors making sure that at 71, he, despite his health complications, probably has significant health and vitality and might, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, live for another 20 years. Oh, my God. Dick Cheney, how much damage could he do to the country at 91? I can't even imagine. But so there's been a big fight because most people do not have access to a heart transplant. And even though they say that it's not a function of age, that it is a function of health, I would suspect that the number of people who are able to get a heart transplant over the age of 70 is de minimis at best. And obviously what you know is there is a money and class issue here. Dick Cheney had access to money. He is of a different class than you and I, and he will remind us of it. And therefore, because he is there, then maybe we need to sort of understand that when it comes to access to health care, it is very different. There are lots of standards, and certain standards apply to you, and then there are other standards that are waived for everyone else. So as I was thinking about Cheney's heart transplant, I went back to a story about Christian Bernard and South Africa. And I am wondering if anybody else remembers the story, because I think more than anything else, this story needs to be told now, especially as there is this interesting election in November of 2012. And I didn't want to admit this, but having traveled through the South and begun to hear a lot of the vitriol about Barack Obama, there is a semblance of race being played over and over and over again. And part of the frustration with Barack is he is a socialist. No way, Jose. He's like he sleeps most of his time with Goldman Sachs. And probably does more to aid and abet Wall Street than any Democrat I would like to support. So he is not a socialist, but what he is definitely our first black president. So the reason I'm bringing this up is I want to read you a little bit from a story I had read in The Guardian in 2009. And I actually had done an interview about this story when I was on the radio many years ago. And I thought, you know, I've got to bring this story back as we were having this interesting conversation about heart transplants. In part, the good news is that so many people, assuming they can find a heart, survive heart transplants, and it's become more routine in America. But the history of heart transplants may not be known in its entire accuracy. There was a movie that was made a number of years ago. It was a documentary. And the title of the documentary was called Hidden Heart. Anybody see that movie, Hidden Heart? Send me an email at studioa@nhnewsviewsblues.org or give us a buzz at 228-0947. Now, what is the story Hidden Heart about? And this is from The Guardian. The controversy over the role of a black surgeon in the world's first successful heart transplant was reignited with the release of the documentary film in South Africa. The film, Hidden Heart, tells the story of Hamilton Naki, a gardener-turned-self-taught surgeon who became a key assistant to pioneering heart surgeon Dr. Christian Bernard in his organ transplant program. Don't you love it? A black guy is the number one assistant to Christian Bernard. Now, this is where the story gets really fun. While Bernard was feted around the world for carrying out the first heart transplant in 1967, Naki was effectively rendered invisible by the apartheid government, retiring in 1991 on a gardener's pension equivalent to £70 a month. But a decade later, with Bernard's help, his contribution gained international recognition. Now listen to the quote from Christian Bernard. Hamilton Naki had better technical skills than I did, Bernard said. He was a better craftsman than me, especially when it came to stitching, and he had the best hands in the theater. Hidden Heart shows how the operation was trumpeted as a public relations coup for the Afrikaner people and the apartheid government. One review of the film notes that one of the proudest moments in South African history might also have been one of the most shameful. And the problem is that he wasn't even allowed, this black South African surgeon who was self-taught, who was a gardener, who came from nothing, wasn't even allowed to be in the operating room. And yet Christian Bernard brought him in because he was too dependent on the talent of these hands and this skill. And it was actually illegal for him to be in the room. Oh my God. Don't you love these stories? I mean, it's so ironic. Look what we do in the name of prejudice. Look what we do. Look what happens with gay marriage. I mean, Dick Cheney's daughter is gay. Why is he always quiet about gay marriage? Because he doesn't want his own flesh and blood to be treated like a secondhand citizen. All right? And then you read the story of Christian Bernard and you find out that the person who helped him was a gardener and a cleaner. And it, you know, when he was first finally recognized by the medical community, he was finally given an honorary Master of Medicine degree in 2003. And what was amazing is that not only was he a principal in Christian Bernard's laboratory, but everyone sit down. It was this black gardener that trained 3,000 surgeons. Oh, my God. I don't know if anybody knows MSNBC and can talk to any of those folks at MSNBC. Frankly, call Fox. Call Rush Limbaugh today. I want that story to be part of the conversation as we're talking about Dick Cheney getting his heart. Because I think these are the stories that are so important because it gives people a knuckle sandwich about, you know, how they are so wedded to their prejudices and they make these assumptions and all these things. And the reason that Christian Bernard could not celebrate the man who performed a significant amount of that very, very important first surgery was that it was illegal for him to be in the room, not because of his skill set, but because he was black. Unbelievable. So I think I'm going to call Red River Theater. I think I'm going to see if they can play the Hidden Heart documentary because it is, it's amazing. It is just amazing. He died at age 78 in 2005, and The Economist published an obituary saying Nakey assisted in the transplant, but later published an amendment saying it had been assured by surgeons at the hospital that he was nowhere near the operating theater at the time. Isn't that pathetic? Isn't that pathetic? So I just want to let you know it's a fascinating story, but the reason they couldn't acknowledge he was in the room was because it was illegal. Fascinating. Anyway, our phone number is 228-0947, 228-0947. That's just one of the stories that I want to make sure you didn't miss as we were talking about whether Dick Cheney actually had the right to have access to getting a new heart given his age. But we are looking at a situation. What is so fascinating to me is that during the Obamacare fight, Sarah Palin is probably the person who is most notorious on this issue. What was the big fight about and why were people told that this was just a terrible bill? Because of something called death panels. Remember that? Oh, my God. And I want everyone to know we have death panels today. And it's called lack of access to a doctor. That's the death panel. It's called poverty. It's called lack of access to a doctor. It means that you're only treated by, you know, emergency rooms. And frankly, if you're probably on Medicaid, you also probably have a variation on the death panel, you know, theme. So I just want to remind everyone that the Cheneys of this world never have to worry about death panels. And maybe that's part of the problem is that we have this bifurcated system and the wealthy and the affluent and those with great insurance, they don't have to worry about it, but the rest of us were on some sort of long, long line, like the line outside to get into the Supreme Court today to hear our argument. And most of them will not get in just the way most of them will not get the heart transplant. And I was thinking, I wrote a piece. You have to go to insideriowa.com today. It was just posted last night. So I write a column about every other week for Insider Iowa. And the title of my column this week is based on an article by, what's his name, Fareed Zakari. He writes for, I think he's on CNN, but he wrote a piece at Time Magazine. And in his piece about Time Magazine, he's commenting on the fight for some kind of universal access to healthcare or some sort of improved healthcare system in the United States, not only because it takes up 17% of our GDP, but because probably it's immoral that we see a growing number of people without access to health insurance. And the title of my piece is something to the effect of, I'm from Taiwan, Obama is from Switzerland, and Mitt, Newt, and Rick are from Mars. Okay, that's the title of my piece. And you're going, Arnie, what the H does that have to do with healthcare? Because in the Time Magazine piece, what Fareed talks about is that in the 1990s, There were two countries that were seeing exploding costs with healthcare. They were seeing lack of access, people dropping out, the system costing them money. It wasn't working. And one country was Switzerland, okay? It looked just like the United States. So what did quirky, economically stable, let's not play in the EU Switzerland decide to do? They basically embraced a variation on Obamacare, all right? They required the individual mandate. Everybody listening, okay? So Switzerland, this very stable economy where lots of rich people put their money into, you know, Swiss bank accounts, they decided to embrace Obamacare. And as a result, they see, I think, their 11% of their GDP is going to healthcare compared to 17% of ours. And they have virtually universal coverage and they have a very, very healthy country. All right. So now you understand why is Obama like Switzerland? Because Switzerland sort of led the way on this issue. What about the question of Taiwan? Well, Taiwan, another capitalist country, they too in the 1990s saw that they were going bonkers on the whole question of healthcare. It was costing them money. People were uninsured. They didn't know what to do. They were hemorrhaging financially. So what did Taiwan do? They did Medicare for all. They created a single insurer, and I think they're down to 9% of their GDP. They're healthier, they have access to insurance, everyone, and it's 9% of their GDP. So I just want to let you know, that's why I'm from Taiwan. Now, why is Mitt, Rick, and Newt from Mars? Because, first of all, they want to get rid of anything that says Obamacare. They want to somehow get rid of government's involvement in healthcare. And I hate to break it to you, but anywhere in the world where everyone has some kind of access to healthcare, it took the government to play a role. So why are they from Mars? Because they may want to test it out on another planet because it doesn't work on Earth. So I just want to let folks know that we're going to be going to a break in a few minutes. And when we come back, there are lots of quirky things happening in Concord. Lots of constitutional amendments, lots of decisions about capping everything. And I don't mean a chapeau. I mean things like capping spending and capping taxes. So because we're in this interesting, brave new world, I thought I would bring someone in who could help us play out the consequences of caps. And it may not be a pretty word and a pretty conversation, but I want to make sure that you stick around and hear it. We're going to go to a break. And when we come back, the head of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute will be joining us. Stick around.
You're listening to WNHN, Concord, New Hampshire.
Oh, groovy, baby.
Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a drone.
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
And up there in the sky, it really is a drone. A new federal law compels the Federal Aviation Administration to allow drones to be used in all sorts of businesses, real estate sales and crop dusting enterprises, and by private investigators and law enforcement, state, federal, and local as well. The law couldn't come at a better time for drone manufacturers who are losing sales due to the winding down of the war in Afghanistan, where drones have been used to gather intelligence and fire missiles. So now, fortunately for them, there's a $6 billion a year drone business right here in America. What protections exist for all of us in this new drone-friendly law? It's a short answer. None. The new drone-friendly law has no protections against what will become the routine aerial surveillance of American life, our American life. So quick, look up in the sky. You may still be able to catch a fleeting glimpse of your rights to privacy and to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures before they are gone. Forever.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union, because freedom can't defend itself.
It's a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
WNHN is supported by you, the listeners, and by Gibson's Bookstore, 27 South Main Street, Concord's independent bookstore since 1898, and by NEA New Hampshire, shaping the future one student at a time. You're on.
All right, thank folks. We are back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson on WNHN 94.7, 228-0947, online streaming at nhnewsviewsblues.org. Interesting conversations today. Yes, death panels, because we have to celebrate what's going on at the Supreme Court. 3 days of hearings. Oh, my God. on, and I have to comment on it on Thursday on WGBH, so I'll have to be taking cryptic notes at midnight. And we had our first newscast with Patch.com, which provided us with some local news and information about what's happening in Concord. But I was reading the paper the other day, and, you know, I can't even keep up with what's going on in Concord. I mean, this is a legislature that gets paid $100 a year. There are 400 of them. And when they got elected in 2010, they decided that change was in order. And, you know, I understand change. I ran for the legislature four or five times, too. Change is good. You know, it's a possibly interesting thing. But the problem with this change is that it more feels like it's a meltdown or a blow up or a tsunami. And I'm not sure that that produces good results. So I'm looking at a op-ed written by Jeff McLynch. And the title was, Tax Spending Caps Would Hurt New Hampshire Economy. And I went, So now they don't just want to write bills. Now they don't even think. They just want to put in a cap. Because if you don't care about looking at the economy and you don't care about doing the math and you don't care about responding to problems or smiling when things are going well, then you just put a cap in and then you're sort of off the hook, I guess. So I want to welcome Jeff McLynch to the program. He is the executive director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, and he is new to this program. So welcome. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the caps on spending and taxes, because my understanding is that the House has got one cap idea. The Senate has another cap idea. Maybe they'll sort of be mutually exclusive and knock each other out. But what are they asking for? What's the House asking for vis-a-vis a tax cap? And then let's talk about the Senate version, and then you can tell me what you think.
Sure. So about a year ago this time, the House passed a constitutional amendment called CACR 6. And what that would have done is required a three-fifths supermajority to increase any tax or fee or to create any new tax or fee. And there are about 15 or 16 states that have similar sort of requirements in place now. Just about a month ago, the Senate took that particular constitutional amendment up and replaced it in its entirety.
the Senate's having such a good time.
And I should add, without any sort of prior hearing, this was done on the floor. So a very dramatic change in mid-course. And what the Senate's version of the bill would do, or the constitutional amendment would do, is to limit the growth in the budget from one biennium to the next to simply the rate of inflation. And that growth could only be exceeded with a similar three-fifths supermajority vote. And so now the two chambers have to come together to try to reconcile their differences. And if they are successful in agreeing on something, that's going to go to the voters this fall.
Okay, let me mirror back so I understand the little nuances of what they're doing. Okay, so what the House did was say in order to raise taxes, you need a three-fifths vote.
That's
okay?
Right.
So they're like tax neurotic, and they want the minority to control. I mean, that's basically what it is. So when you decide on taxes, you don't really care about what the majority thinks. Now you care really what the minority thinks because they're going to dictate tax policy in the state of New Hampshire.
Right. This shifts the balance of power towards
I love democracies like this. Somehow it's like putting your finger on the scale and saying, not exactly a democracy. Okay. That doesn't surprise me. It sounds a lot like the House. Then the Senate, though, what surprises me is maybe makes this bait and switch on the floor of the Senate. Not exactly Democratic either because they didn't get any public input, but maybe the public is expendable. And they decide that they don't want to cap taxes or limit how we raise them. They want to put into the Constitution that we cannot spend more than the CPI.
Well, that's an interesting wrinkle in their bill. So it says inflation, but the measure also stipulates that inflation would be defined by the legislature in the session following the adoption of the constitutional amendment. So let's say the voters approve this in November 2012. Come 2013, the legislature would have to define what it means by inflation.
I think they should use the cost of health care. I think that would be great. I think that would be fabulous. It's been going up so rapidly, double-digit inflation. Oh, my God, I'm running on that platform. Can I run for office?
Well, given the role it plays in the state budget, it's certainly one idea.
So this is unbelievable. So they are going to then decide what inflation is defined by right after they assume the constitutional amendment passes, if it passes with a, two-thirds vote. Isn't that what it's required by the people? And Does that mean that their decision and their definition of inflation stays permanently, or can we adjust the definition of inflation every 2 years?
I believe that it can be changed, but I think that it would require a subsequent three-fifths supermajority to change it.
Okay, so they're sort of embracing a little bit of the House version of the three-fifths.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that I've heard all this, translate this into pain. I want to know, what does the House version of tax policy, which says you need to have a three-fifths vote in order to raise taxes, play that sucker out? You said a number of states have it. So tell me about those states. Do I want to move there?
Sure.
You know, or are they places where everybody is like fleeing and going to, you know, some nice warm place in, you know, Central America?
I think what's important to keep in mind is that while substantively or on paper they may appear very different, when you look at their ultimate consequences, they're pretty similar.
Okay.
That they would severely limit the legislature's flexibility to meet changing economic circumstances, to meet shifting public preferences, or even to respond to things like natural disasters. These are very real constraints.
Are we talking like California?
California is definitely a state that's suffered from this.
When I think gridlock and I think hemorrhaging and I think throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I think California.
That's exactly right. And so you noted at the outset, we have 400 legislators in the state house, in the state House of Representatives. We've always prided ourselves as a representative deliberative democracy, and these sorts of amendments would replace that deliberative democracy with very rigid caps on either taxes or spending.
But the other thing is that it means you don't think. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but you want to look at what's happening economically. You want to look – and frankly, you want to look because there are waves of recessions and depressions that happen across the country or happen across a state. I mean, you know, look at the North Country. The North Country has been in depression for the last 40 years. They've never recovered. And this seems to me to be like tying your hands so you can't be responsive, which is why the heck did you run if you don't want to respond? And then isn't there another story here, Jeff? And I'm one of those people that, you know, for whatever reason, I love taxes. I think they're more fun than, you know, going gambling, because you learn a lot about math. And when I hear what the state wants to do, one, they want to either, you know, three-fifths vote to raise taxes, or they want to cap spending to whatever the Senate decides is inflation as they define inflation. And that gets me nervous. But here's what I'm hearing: property taxes. And as I hear the state, you know, doing this lovely dance, sounding like they're, you know, just so aggressive on the financial problems facing New Hampshire, tell me who gets screwed in this conversation. Because I have a funny feeling it's people at the local level.
Well, it definitely creates a dynamic that puts more pressure on local property taxes.
More?
If the state has a difficult time, you know, setting its budget within that constraint, they're going to have to enact cuts throughout the budget. And as we've seen in the last go around, local aid was certainly one of the prime targets. And as a result, you'll likely see that pressure pushed down into property taxes and greater pressure to raise property taxes as a result. We took a look at this recently and looked at the states that have constitutional restraints on either taxes or spending. Mm-hmm. And if you look back over the past decade and adjust for inflation, what you see is that in those states, property taxes rose by about 39%.
Now, and they're not the highest in the nation.
Right.
I just want everyone to know this. Oh, my. How high can we go? Right. Remember those? What are those? They're those thermometers that you see when people are raising money for the United Way. Well, I think we should put a thermometer in front of every single city and town in New Hampshire. And then after this constitutional amendment passes, we should see how high our property taxes can go. It'll be great. And I think we should all look at it together so we can all really be pissed. Just be amazed. Oh, my God. So that you 39%?
That's right.
Make a bumper sticker.
Sure.
Put that on a billboard.
And there are obviously a lot of factors that go into higher property taxes nationwide.
Yeah.
But it makes it. It certainly illustrates one of the potential dynamics that could occur if this constitutional amendment became law.
Actually, I'm not even sure it's a potential dynamic. If you see what they've done now without the constitutional amendment, and I guess I have another question here. We were talking to Dan Toohey with Patch, and he was saying that this week they're going to be looking at gambling again. And I'm not sure, you know, it's actually going to get anywhere because Governor Lynch has finally decided it might harm the quality of life here and he will veto it. But let's just say that Lynch was out of the way and this bill might pass. And the version of the casino bill that seems to get a lot of Republicans excited, Republicans that historically hated gambling, but suddenly they see it as maybe an interesting vehicle for destroying government. And what they want to do is they want to pass gambling, and they want to use all the millions of dollars that are going to roll in from gambling to lower business taxes. Now, here's my dilemma. You need a three-fifths vote to raise taxes. Do you need a three-fifths vote to do lowering taxes?
No, you don't. And actually, looking at that gambling bill through the looking at that gambling bill through the lens of CACR6 reveals two really interesting things. First is that if this constitutional amendment were in place, the House's version of the constitutional amendment were in place, you probably would not be able to enact that gambling bill without a three-fifths supermajority.
Why?
Because it creates a new tax on table gaming income. And as a result of that, you wouldn't be able to pursue that.
I can't even use the word. It's not polite on the radio. But this is so exciting. How stupid are we? Oh, my God.
Conversely, if let's suppose the gambling bill were to pass before CACR6, the supermajority version, became law, and you adopted business tax cuts, let's suppose at some point, which is pretty likely under this gambling bill, that casino revenues fluctuate and there's insufficient revenue to make these business tax cuts. Well, if you had to reconsider those tax cuts under a supermajority requirement for tax increases, you'd have a very hard time doing that. In fact, a commission in California that looked into this question, one of their chief recommendations was to remove this supermajority requirement because it prevented the state from reconsidering tax breaks or reassessing tax policy over the long run.
I just want everyone to know who you're listening to. You're listening to Jeff McLynch. He is the executive director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. He is playing out for you the consequences of all these pieces of legislation that don't fit together. I mean, Jeff, here's what I keep saying to people. In isolation, you know, you can look at these bills, but these bills are not going to be passed in isolation. They're going to be passed with a whole, you know, group of bills that are already in existence today and laws. And if you actually play them out, they are going to be more destructive, and they're going to strangle the ability of the legislature to operate in any meaningful or reasonable way, because they fight each other. And not only do they fight each other, but I don't think anybody has actually contemplated putting – like you put four of them together, and what you find out is not only do you have gridlock, you're probably going to go into bankruptcy as a state, because it's inevitable given what you just described.
Well, and
– oh, my Lord.
You know, bankruptcy may sound like an extreme outcome, but it certainly has had an effect on borrowing costs. Supermajority requirements for tax increases, that is, has certainly had an impact on borrowing costs in states that now have them. If you take, for instance, Nevada, in 2011, Moody's explicitly downgraded Nevada's bond rating in part because of the presence of this sort of supermajority requirement. Arizona had the same outcome occur, and there's been some academic research that's looked at what having these supermajority requirements in place means for state borrowing costs. And what they found is that on average, states that have them pay about $1,800 more in interest for every $1 million that they borrow. So there's a very direct impact from these sort of.
So as we're looking at this, are there any constitutional questions? Can New Hampshire do this? I mean, is there any requirement that we, I don't know, use our IQ? I have something so basic. But it just seems to me it doesn't work. It's especially here because we already have such a lean and mean government. You study fiscal policy. You look at the 50 states. Can you tell the state of New Hampshire, like, are we like spendthrifts? Is New Hampshire, does we have a huge state government? Do we raise more money per capita than any other state? I just want to know, how bad is New Hampshire that we suddenly need to put on all these shackles on the legislature so they basically can't operate in any kind of real fiscal economy?
Sure. I mean, the supermajority requirement in many ways is a solution in search of a problem. I think you know well the political culture here in New Hampshire. People
– cheap. Excuse me. Did I say the word cheap? Thrifty. This is New England. Yes, keep going.
The legislature does not have a routine practice of approving tax increases. If you look at New Hampshire relative to to every other state, the most recent data from the Census Bureau are from 2009. Our state and local level – of taxation relative to the size of our economy was 47th in the country, well below the national average. So there isn't any imminent danger of us jumping into the national lead in that regard.
And let me then remind everyone about education aid, because in the end, this is the most expensive item, one of the most expensive items, if not the most expensive item that we pay for together as a community, you know, as a state. And we know that the Claremont lawsuit has really sort of unearthed a lot of problems for the New Hampshire legislature. And what they've done is they've actually made them be obligated to care, because up until the Claremont lawsuit, they could punt. And they did, over and over and over again. You will love this story because I've been around way too long. Governor Sununu was very unhappy. And the reason Governor Sununu was unhappy was that year the lottery made, I don't know, a couple of million dollars more than anticipated. And he was so upset that all of his cash was coming in from the lottery that he decided he didn't want to send all the lottery dollars back to public education. Because to quote John, my favorite Sununu, they're both John, anyway, is that he said, oh, my God, they'll be spending money like kids in a candy store. All right. That was back in the 80s. And we're talking about a tiny, tiny amount of money. But John Sununu was worried that they would not know what to do with the extra 50 cents. Okay, this is what was going on. Here's the good news. Because it was in the Constitution that all the lottery dollars had to go back to public education. And you couldn't sit on them. You couldn't hold them. You couldn't say mañana. It was the Speaker of the House, I believe, was Donna Stytek, who was another good Republican, who said, you're not reading the Constitution, Governor. You're wrong. So that's what happened. And then eventually we ended up realizing that even the lottery didn't do much, because people didn't need 50 cents. They needed, you know, $50,000 or $500,000, because there was such inequity in schooling. So we passed the Claremont Education lawsuit because the state never figured out that they really had a duty to support. Now I'm looking at what's happening today, and you were just telling me that before we pass these constitutional amendments, before we decide to perhaps, you know, get the courts out of the funding of public education, that we are sending less and less dollars back to cities and towns. Is that true both educationally and for other kinds of supports?
I think education aid has been frozen in this last budget, but we've certainly seen reductions in revenue sharing, for instance, in recent years. Just to return to your point about constitutionality, as far-reaching and as long-lasting as the damage would be from something like CACR6, I think it's important to keep in mind that it's only one of several constitutional amendments that are being considered at the State House right now, and you may have devoted other shows to this topic. But for instance, on education, there's an amendment, CACR 12, that would radically change the state's role in financing public education. There's also another constitutional amendment, CACR 13, which the Senate will take up in the next month or two, that would seek to prohibit an income tax in New Hampshire, but would have consequences well beyond that, essentially freezing in place our current tax system. And there are others also being considered about the court's role and in setting laws. So This is all just CACR 6 is just one piece of a much broader agenda.
It seems like they want to use the Constitution to sort of build a moat around New Hampshire. You know, normally constitutions are about protecting rights, and they're actually really about sort of ensuring opportunity. And I look at these guys, and it's almost like opportunity is a bad word. You know, it's like a three-letter word. And what they're doing is they want future generations to have to play by their rules and their limitations and their fear. That's what this is. I'm afraid. I don't trust. So guess what? We're putting that into the Constitution, and not a prob. You won't have to worry about anything except the one thing you will have to worry about is that every city and town will become a little fiefdom. Why do you need a state? Think about this, Jeff. If they pass all those damn constitutional amendments, the state of New Hampshire is expendable. Think about it. So you're on your own, Pittsfield. You're on your own, Bo. That's really what this is about. Mm-hmm. And you know, it might have worked. I was watching Elizabeth on television the other night. That was Queen Elizabeth. And I'm thinking, whoa, they had fiefdoms back then too, but there was a lot of blood on the floor. I'm not quite sure I want to go there. So there are a lot of amendments. Do you think, given your time here and your exposure to this legislature, do you think they're going to pass?
It's interesting at this stage. It's certainly something that is going to occupy a lot of media attention in the coming weeks, because the House has made no bones about its distaste for the Senate's approach on spending caps. And similarly, the Senate has indicated it much prefers its approach to the House's approach on.
So there is a good news story
taxes.
Here. The good news story is they don't like each other. And if the House and Senate, I mean, I think the Senate is looking at the House going, oh my God, they think it's the Wild West. I think they're going to start handing out spurs and little sheriff badges. I mean, that's really what they think, you know? And then the Senate is trying to say, like, we're a little more reasonable. We want to take our time. And so what may actually save us isn't that they both don't want some form of constitutional amendment, is that the two agendas may not necessarily blend well together because they may not find consensus.
There's certainly that outcome, but I think ultimately, what may prevent these from becoming law is the public. And the public has indicated on taxes when asked about how to approach the budget deficit last year, they indicated that largely that taxes ought to be part of a balanced solution to a balanced approach to what the challenges the state faced. And we didn't see that. And I think that some of the polling that we've seen already on something like CACR 13, the income tax constitutional amendment, there is not the public support out there for changing the Constitution that way.
Well, you know, New Hampshire is a very, very quirky state. I mean, we tend to have a very strong libertarian streak. And I've said it over and over again. We don't trust big government. We don't trust big church. So those are the two things that we don't trust. But the fact that we don't trust big government doesn't mean we don't want any government. And the fact that we don't trust big government doesn't mean that we don't want reasonable and rational government. And I think there is also something else that a lot of us are beginning to try to figure out how to understand and how to address. And I've always said that Americans are philosophically conservative. I mean, that if you go back to the beginning of this country, I mean, we were fighting, you know, big government, i.e. England. And yet, while we may be philosophically conservative, we tend to be kind of operationally liberal. And that means that, you know, we like our Medicare. We like our roads repaired. We want our kids to go to good schools. We want our university system to be affordable. We want to be able to call the Attorney General's office and actually have someone who will protect us from consumer fraud. I mean, it would be kind of a nice thing. And when we get a divorce, we'd like to be able to get it within a year and not six, because there's a judge waiting for us so that we can actually end this painful marriage. And I think if you end up asking people what kind of government they want, it's exactly that. And when you say to them, if that's what you want, then how the H are you going to pay for it? And I think that's almost – and that's the question that nobody's ever put to the Speaker of the House and to the legislature, is what kind of government do you want? I mean, I don't mean none. I want the answer, because I think people need to hear what that answer is and then decide, does it fit with their life?
Yeah,
that doesn't happen.
I do think, you know, again, referring to that polling, there is an expectation among the public that the government is going to have some sort of role in increasing employment, in bolstering the economy. And something like a spending cap or a tax cut is really going to limit the abilities of the government to make the kinds of investments that are going to foster economic growth. Take, for instance, I-93, a project that's been going on for years. In the absence of additional federal funding, the state will have to generate millions of dollars to complete that project. And if either version of CACR 6 were to become law, it would be exceptionally difficult, if not impossible.
So tell them the last time we raised the gas tax? 1991 or 92?
I think that's right. Yeah, 1992. It's been at least a couple decades.
It's been a couple of decades. Yeah. And I just want to remind everyone, and here's what people don't know. They don't know. You pay taxes on a gallon of gasoline, not on a dollar. So, for example, when it was $1.16 for a gallon of gas, you paid the same amount, ka-ching, in taxes on that $1.16 as you would on $4. So people see the price of gas going up, and they assume that the state of New Hampshire must be actually bringing in more cash.
Right.
Well, that's true in a general sales tax. In a general sales tax, you know, you spend $100, you send the state more money. You spend $50, you send the state less money. Gasoline, however, everyone, is not paid by the dollar. It is paid by the gallon. So when we stopped in place in 1991 or 92, the gas tax, do you know how we are like shooting ourselves in the like transportation foot?
Absolutely.
But people don't know this. Mm-hmm. And they literally think that, oh my God, we must have more money because look at the price of gasoline. It's gone through the roof. And they don't know. Not only is it not more money, it's less money because cars are more efficient, and because the price of gasoline has gotten so high, less people are driving. It's just – it's remarkable.
Absolutely. And that's one of the changing circumstances we would be left unable to respond to if a tax cap or spending cap were put in place. Cars are becoming more efficient. People are purchasing less gas as a result. Gas tax revenue is not going to respond, and we're not going to be able to pay for roads and bridges and maintenance.
I remember before I let you go, I used to do radio up in New London. And one day this guy calls me up and goes, "My grandmother listens to you every day." And I said, "Well, that's very nice of you." He said, "No, my grandmother doesn't do taxes and she doesn't do public policy and she never reads the newspaper. She loves you." And I said, "Why?" She says, "When you get done," she's like, "Boy, are we stupid in New Hampshire." And it's not a policy conversation. It's like, it's just common sense. And I think that's what is so terrifying, is that we see this absence of common sense. And I think the greatest fear for the New Hampshire legislature is someone actually asks them to play it out and then explain how do we live. And if they can't explain it, maybe you shouldn't vote for it. All right, Jeff McLynch, the director of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. It was a pleasure. I have a feeling we'll talk a lot.
I look forward to it.
It will be great. And I also want to let people know that they can send us emails at studioa@nhnewsviewsblues.org. That's nhnewsviewsblues.org. That's our website. We stream live on the website. Let me share with you a little bit before I say au revoir to Jeff and go to a break. Let me tell you what's happening in the next hour. The next hour gets wild. Fasten your seatbelts. We passed a bill over the governor's veto called, I think it's House Bill 542, which is the parental objection bill. This is a bill where a parent decides for whatever reasons, religious, they don't like the French, who knows, they don't believe in evolution. They can walk into a school and say to the school, "You know what? I want a new course for my kid. I'm going to tell you what I want you to teach, and you have to do it." And I'm like, wait a minute. Go to private school, homeschool. You can't do this to public schools. They can. So it turns out that there was a board meeting in Nashua with the school board where they suddenly realized they had to deal with this policy. And members of the school board were like, "This is nuts. We should just ignore it." So we're going to talk to the reporter who covered that first school board meeting as they suddenly tried to do a dance with this new law. And then after that, we're going to be talking with a professor from UNH Law School, the University of New Hampshire, who's going to talk to us about a position paper he wrote about this, because he said it is more than nuts, this law. This law really could almost sort of crumble public education because it will be very, very difficult to implement. It will be very, very costly. And in addition to which, the bill, no surprise here, doesn't give any real guidance. So every school district feels like it's on their own, Jack, and that is a very terrifying thing. And then last but not least, after we do that, we are going to be talking with the director of Citizens for Tax Justice based in Washington, D.C., and we're going to be talking about how corporate lobbying has bought a wonderful thing, no tax burden for very rich corporations. Don't you wish you had one of those lobbyists? All right, everyone. We're going to go to can I do a station ID now? Let's do a little respect. We'll do a little respect.
You are listening to WNHN LP 94.7 FM, Concord, New Hampshire.
The category, Republican presidential candidates and family planning.
I'm singer-songwriter Patty Larkin, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
This is Jeopardy!
These two candidates served on the board or were big supporters of Planned Parenthood. This candidate said no American woman should be denied access to family planning because of her economic condition. This governor, later presidential candidate, signed a bill lifting restrictions on abortion. This presidential candidate, as a member of the House of Representatives, said we need to make family planning a household word. And the answers? President Dwight Eisenhower and Mr. Conservative Senator Barry Goldwater served on boards and were supporters of Planned Parenthood. Governor Ronald Reagan signed legislation expanding access to abortion. President Richard Nixon proclaimed the importance of access to family planning for all women in America. And President George H.W. Bush at one point wanted to make family planning a household word. All this makes you wonder. What happened to the principle of small government, the principle that the government should keep its hands off our bodies and not dictate decisions that should be left up to each individual to determine for herself?
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union, because freedom can't defend itself.
You heard that dirge that we were playing just before we went to this, or right after the Civil Liberties.